You should have pages 11 and 12 in the notes. We're going to talk about studying and using the text. And we're going to, did everybody get a copy? Okay. I have one right here. I have extra copies if you didn't get one. I went down through there and laid them down where I thought people were sitting, but I may have missed somebody. Okay, anybody else? Okay. We're going to get into some material tonight that would be helpful to anybody, whether they're a preacher or a Bible class teacher or just want to study their Bible. Thank you. Excuse me. People have asked me how I am tonight. I've said, oh, I'm fine. Well, I really have a cold, okay? I'm just all stuffed up, sneezy, cry. I'm not really sick. I just have a cold. Yes?
When a preacher gets up, should he announce that he has a cold?
That is appropriate. Yes. You always are transparent and keep your congregation informed.
if you say, I'm not going to do very well today because I have a cold.
No, don't apologize. People will find out how you do soon enough, so don't tell them in advance that you're not going to do well.
Should you shake hands?
Yeah, probably not. You probably should not shake hands. Every sermon must have a text. The reason being, if you don't, all you're giving is a secular speech. If your sermon is not rooted in Scripture, you're just giving a speech. And you hear lots of those. I heard one today, part of it on television. Our president gave a speech. He didn't exactly have it rooted in Scripture. But we hear lots of speeches. We are not speech givers as preachers. We are gospel preachers. Therefore, our job is to make sure that we start with a text and throughout the sermon are true to the text. Now, the purpose of the sermon is to link together two things. Mark has inspired me to mark on the board. Because I thought I was terrible, I discovered I probably could not,
you see why I use a projector?
Yeah. We are talking about building sermons to meet people's needs. We ask the question, do we begin with a text or do we begin with the needs of the people?
The needs?
Needs, either one.
If you start with one, you move to the other.
Yeah, you start at either end. If I'm reading a text, and I say, that's really good stuff, and I need to preach on that, and Mark, I got a couple of sermons out of your class tonight about the leadership of Moses. I thought that was just marvelous stuff. If I'm reading a text, then I need to ask, what need does that text meet? If that text doesn't meet a need, should I preach on it? And if I am going to, why? What's the purpose in the sermon? I heard a preacher one time begin a sermon by quoting the first chapter of Matthew and the genealogy. And when he got through, he said, see, I can do it. And I thought, why? What purpose did that accomplish? Did that meet any need anybody in that audience had?
No.
Probably not.
And bring desire to know about genealogy of Jesus.
Yeah. It might. It certainly would have, at the time Matthew wrote it, for Jewish people who were interested in genealogies and wanted to make sure they were seed of Abraham. But for a congregation in a meeting, I doubt if that was really high on their needs list. Now, if we observe a need in somebody's life or in our congregational life, what's the thing we go immediately to? What is the text that speaks to that need? The sermon is the connection between a text and a need and a text. Okay, are we clear? We got that? Now, what we do with our text, what we take from our text, determines the type of sermon it is. Were you aware of the fact that there are types of sermons? Later, we're going to have a whole lesson on each of the three major types of sermons. We're going to have a lesson on each of the three major types. And we're going to talk about the advantages and disadvantages. But for right now, we'll just simply state them. If we take only the subject from the text, if we take only the topic from the text, what kind of sermon do we have? A topical sermon. In the history of preaching, topical sermons are far ahead of all other kinds, types of sermons. In the history. Now, more recently, that has swung. And people are not preaching as many topical sermons as they used to. Sometimes the only way to cover a matter is topically. I will say as a hint that these are the easiest kind of sermons to abuse. Why would you guess that's true?
It's easy to take them out of context.
You can lift that right out of context. It's got your word in it that you're looking for, and you just go wherever you want to go. And you pay no attention to the setting of the text, the meaning of the text, the application of the text. It's got your word in it. I had a young man deliver a topical sermon in one of my classes at the School of Preaching. And after he was through, as I was critiquing his sermon, I said, "Are you sure that your text really provided that topic for you?" And he said, in all seriousness, "Well, I thought about that, but it was as close as I could get." And I thought, bless his heart. You know, he'll go forth and be a great preacher. It's not just getting as close as you can. We've got to make sure that the topic is in that particular text. Now, if we take the topic and the major points from the text, guess what kind of sermon we have?
Textual.
A textual. That's when the topic comes from it and the major points. If you have three or four or however many you have, if each of them is set in that text, either directly stated or very much there by inference, then you have a textual sermon. I think textual sermons are better, generally speaking, than topical sermons. If you take your subject matter and your main points and your subordinate points from the text, what do you have?
Expository.
Expository. In my judgment, the strongest kind of preaching is expository preaching. The reason being, I think when we preach expositorily, we preach the Bible. We let it speak. It is the framework for what we're saying. Now, as long as we're true to the text, as long as we don't abuse the text, we are preaching the Bible. And I may have said, because I often say, that I'm afraid we preach about the Bible more than we preach the Bible. And so I really like expository preaching. And it seems to be the wave now of all of the books that I have in my library that have been written in the last few years about preaching. The most of them have been written about expository preaching. Because I think people are beginning to see that that's the strongest kind of preaching. Now, I'll be honest with you now. After I've given you the three major kinds of sermons, topical, textual, and expository, lots of sermons are hybrids. Okay? Lots of sermons are a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of something else. And if you are a purist, you don't like that. If you're a realist, you may say that's kind of how life goes. But I'm giving you at least the technical, the purist definition of what makes the three kinds of sermons. But what do they all have in common? A text. That's why we're talking about studying and using the text. No matter what kind of sermon, whether it's topical, textual, or expository, you still start with a text. So you've got to have a text, you've got to know how to study the text, and you've got to know how to use the text. Questions about the kinds of sermons? Anybody want to ask a question, make a comment? We'll be glad to give you time to do that before we move on.
What would be the easiest type of lesson to start with?
Topical. I think that's one reason they, in the history of preaching, have been used most often. They are the easiest to prepare. You know what you need to prepare a topical sermon? One of two books. A concordance or a Knave's Topical Bible. Get you one, go to it. And that makes it pretty easy. The danger, as I said, is that you'll end up taking those passages out of context and using them incorrectly and misapplying them. I've done that. I've thrown away lots of sermons because as I got older and understood the text better, I realized I did not use that correctly. I used it like I'd heard it used, but those preachers had probably heard it like they had preached like they'd heard it used, and we had repeated a misuse of those sermons. Yes?
Some of the sermons in the Bible, I think you can really classify.
Yep.
I mean, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount is
eclectic, to say the least, right?
And Paul's sermons and Stephen's sermons, sometimes they go on tangent.
Absolutely. I admit that. That sometimes the sermons of the Bible, now you can do a lot more with Peter's sermon in Acts 2. That one seems to have a flow to it. And it's pretty easy to follow. But who would like to outline Jesus' Sermon on the Mount? I mean, that'd be a nightmare to try to outline that. Because it goes here and it goes there. And there's two or three verses about this. And there's a verse about this. And there's something else about this. And so I would not want to be grading Jesus in a homiletics class, you know. He knows far more about it than I do. And his sermon has stood the test of time. Mine haven't. So I'll give him credit. Now, because of the importance of the text to the sermon, we must study it carefully. And careful study will keep us from misusing a text. Now, I want to make a point here about our accusing other folks of misusing text. And we do that, don't we? Mm-hmm. We listen to folks preach, denominational folks, and we say, boy, did he take that out of context. Listen. I have heard some of the strangest applications of texts in our church buildings by our people that I just didn't know what to think. And it illustrated to me, at least, that anybody can fall victim to misusing a text. If we do not pay the price, that is study, diligent study, to know what it means, we must constantly be on guard lest we misuse a verse. And we have no more right to do it than XYZ denomination has to do it. We just simply have no more right than they do. Now, what we're going to talk about at this point is in your book, Building Sermons to Meet People's Needs. It's from chapter 2. And the authors point out three perspectives from which to study a passage. And I said a while ago, we're going to look at something that would be beneficial to anybody, no matter whether you're a preacher, Bible class teacher, just a student of the Word. These things absolutely are valid. First of all, we study it from the historical perspective. Now, why would we study the Bible from a historical perspective?
Well, the Bible is a book of history.
It is a book of historical events. The Bible is a book set in history, which records to us historical events. Therefore, one of the things that we need to do in looking at a text is look at the history that surrounds that. I made the point a little later in the outline and then thought, well, maybe I should have put it back up here. There is a term that applies to this. It is called time coloring. Time coloring. What would you guess time coloring means?
Painting a picture of what it meant to the original audience.
The times color our understanding of the event. Now, I'll give you a for instance. We have Jesus' first miracle in John chapter 2. What was that event? Do you remember? Changing the water to wine at the marriage feast in Cana of Galilee. Marriage, wedding. I know what a wedding is. I've conducted lots of them. Guy puts on a tuxedo, woman puts on a white gown, they walk down the center aisle of the church building, there are candles burning, the preacher says a few words, pronounces them husband and wife, they kiss each other, they go out and people throw rice on them. That's a wedding. Now, if that's my concept, am I going to have trouble in understanding John 2? Why?
That wasn't a wedding in the first century.
That was a different time. I must look at that passage through first century eyes, not through 21st century eyes. I must allow the times to color my understanding of that event. That's why you ought to have some books in your library, whether you're a preacher, Bible class teacher, whomever you are, that will help you do that. Manners and Customs in the Bible is one such book. It's a good resource book that lets you know what was going on in Bible times, how they did things. And so you read about a wedding and you look up weddings in Manners and Customs in the Bible and it tells you what a wedding was like in the first century. And all of a sudden you say, I get it now. It was a much more elaborate event. It went on for days. The whole village turned out for this wedding of a peasant Jewish maid. And so we look at it differently. We must always study a passage historically. And although the Bible is a book written for all ages, it is still written against the background of ancient times. So we ask some questions. What biblical period is the text sent in? Set in, I mean. Now, my wife proofreads this, and she reminds me that a preposition is something you ought never to end a sentence with. Some of you didn't get that, but that's okay. And I still do it.
What are you talking about?
What are you talking about? Good report. But we want to know, what's the Bible period here? Because even though we're looking at a biblical event, is every biblical event set in the same historical period? Of course not. We've got thousands of years of Bible history. You know, if we take the 1600 BC to the 100 AD, you know, we've got 1700 years, but we are another 2000 years removed from that. So we're looking back through a long historical corridor trying to understand things that went on. So I want to know, what was the biblical period? Was this the Mosaical period? Was it the patriarchal period? Was it the Christian period? I want to know what part of the world was it going on? Was it going on in? I want to know who was in charge, who ruled. I want to know what part of the biblical world even is involved, and what the customs and religious practices and economic situations of people at that time were. I need to set it down in history and take off my 21st century glasses which are going to mess me up, and look at it through the glasses of the time. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Okay?
So that's where the coloring comes from?
That's where the color.
Colored.
My glasses are not colored, thank you. They don't even have lines in them. I am too vain to have lines. There'd be so many lines going through there, I'd never be able to say anything. Second is the analytical perspective. At this part of the study, we want to know what, why, and how of textual analysis. We're trying to discover the thoughts of the text, the flow of the text. Tell me what keeps us from getting the thoughts of the text or the flow of the text. What's one of the major things?
Preconceived ideas.
Well, I didn't think of that, but that would be a good one. Preconceived ideas. Don't confuse me with facts. My mind's already made up. So I may go into it already believing here's what it teaches, so therefore that's all I see. Okay? Anybody else? What keeps us from getting the thoughts, the flow of the text? Now, obviously, I have something in mind. I'll beam it to you. It's not working. My beamer is not working. Not reading enough around the text. If you sit down, or if you sit down, to read a single verse, you're going to have a hard time understanding what that verse really meant to the original readers without reading the verses that surround it. That's one reason why we sometimes have to go right into other chapters. You know, we assume that Paul had been to class to Mark, and he got to the end of a chapter and he said, I'm going to put a peg down right there. He did not. Okay? He just kept on writing. As you well know, it was divided into chapters and verses much later. And so we get to the end of a chapter, what kind of clicks in our mind? What do we kind of think in our mind about the thought?
That's the end of it.
But it may continue right on into the next chapter without missing a beat. As a matter of fact, do you realize that sometimes happens from book to book? Think of Luke and Acts, written by the same fellow, Dr. Luke. If you read the last chapter of Luke and the first chapter of Acts, you don't miss a beat. It is a seamless flow from one book right into another. So if you want to understand what Luke was talking about in the last chapter, read the first chapter of Acts, and you're going to say, oh, well, okay, they went to Jerusalem like he told them to. They waited until they were endued with power from on high like he told them to. And look at chapter 2. Wow! It's happening! We've got to read verses. You may have to read a whole chapter. You may have to read two or three chapters. You may have to read the book to get the flow of the passage. We need to do the following. Read the text from various translations. Now, all translations are not of equal value. But sometimes how one translation says a thing is very helpful in understanding that verse, that passage. So I would recommend comparing translations. If you don't have a comparative translation that just gives you across the page several, then get you some Bibles, open them up, and read it out of various translations. Yes, Mark?
Something I was going to mention on your last point, there are some places, like especially like in Romans, where if I'm going to preach on it, I have to read the whole book over
yes.
a few times.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's hard to get all that in your mind at the same time.
Absolutely.
And I heard that G. Campbell Morgan, before he ever preached on a text, said that he would read the book. He tried to read it 40 times.
Ooh, my. He must have had more time than I've got, but then that's, or he was preaching from Jude or something, Obadiah. So. But read the text from various translations. Number two, divide the text into paragraphs. Now, that's a little subjective, I understand. But what we're trying to do is get some manageable size sections. And you certainly want to read the paragraph. Maybe you have a Bible that divides the text into paragraphs. And generally speaking, those are very good. Now, the division of the paragraph is done by men. They may hit it, they may not. But at least that breaks it down into a manageable section of Scripture to deal with. So I want to look at the paragraph. I want to state the principal idea of each paragraph without just regurgitating it word for word for word for word for word. I want to get an overall view of the paragraph. As a matter of fact, next week, I've already sent your notes to Jane because I'm leaving tomorrow for a back-to-back teacher's workshop and gospel meeting. I'm going to be gone until next Thursday. And I wanted to get her the notes so she can run them off. But I made the point there that your text says ETS is one of the terms you need to learn and is a part of the nuts and bolts of building better sermons. ETS is the essence of the text in a sentence, which means you ought to be able to draw one thought and get it down, boil it down into 12 or 15 words as to the meaning of that text. Why is that important?
Because that's what you want to convey to the people who believe in it.
Absolutely. If it's not clear in your mind, what's the chances you're going to make it clear in somebody else's mind? Yeah, it's not very good, is it? And I heard preaching, I suspect you do too, have too, that I thought, that text is not clear in his mind. And the reason I know it's not clear in his mind is because he's not clearly conveying the meaning of that text in his sermon. You've got to get it crystal clear in your mind before you can convey it to anybody else. So, write the principal idea of each paragraph. This paragraph is about. This paragraph said. However you begin it. And then read and study each paragraph to discover subordinate ideas. Okay, I've got the paragraph in my mind. Now, here is a point that relates to that. This is a subordinate point that substantiates, goes to the main thought of the passage. Questions about this approach?
But that's contained within the passage, though.
Yes.
More than thoughts.
Yes. Yes.
One thing, when you talk about the various translations there, I'm having an ongoing stay with a young couple who are not Christians, and when first announced it, what translation do you use? I said, we use King James. So I've been printing out, I go to online Bible, and I print out all the verses we want to use. But then I'll sometimes put two or three other translations next to them and put them in a box so we can look at them at the same time. And even though they both said they were using King James, but and that's helped me a lot too, to look at them side by side as we go through.
Our computer's marvelous.
Oh, yes.
That you can do that. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, sir.
One problem I've had, and you can probably appreciate, the more I study Paul's writings, you know, Peter said Paul wrote some things that are hard to be understood.
Yes.
I don't think that Paul knew what a short sentence was
until
he got to Thessalonians. I mean, some of those sentences of his cover seven, eight verses.
Yeah, they go on and on. You're right.
It's hard to, you know, condense something that Paul's written. Mm-hmm.
More so than other writers.
Yes.
I guess the question is, and I think I asked this before, but when do you stop? I mean, like when you say on the first section on historical, when do you say, I have enough? I mean, 2 days or 2 hours or what? You can go on forever.
I think you always study more than you will tell your audience. But I think basically you study till it's clear in your mind. You're satisfied. If I'm preaching on the wedding feast in Cana of Galilee, as I used that illustration long ago, I studied the historical background long enough that I know in my mind what that would have been like. That I can see in my mind what went on there. That it's clear to me. That'll take different lengths of time for different people. How many resources you have may determine some of that. With computers, you know, it is easy to find a lot of good material. Now, you have to have the same caution about computer stuff as you do commentaries. It's done by somebody. And they may be right on or they may not be right on. But I would say that I study Mark until I have it clear in my mind, I've got it. If I don't ever get it, I don't preach on that. Because it's not fair to my audience. If I'm going to say, I don't understand this very well, so I'm going to confuse you today. Now, I may confuse them enough already, but I want to make sure that the thing is clear in my mind. Yes, ma'am.
One of the best lessons we learned, or I learned when Mark and I were in school, was that when you get finished studying, you know, usually a book, a chapter, whatever, go back and start at verse 1, chapter 1, verse 1, and read the whole thing. Because if you get a letter from home, you're not going to read just one paragraph and put it down and say, well, I'll read the rest of it tomorrow.
Yes.
You know? No, you read
that
the whole
is
thing.
True. That is true.
And I think the first one I ever did that with was 2 Timothy, and I was bawling by the end. I mean, it's
so moving. It, depending on the length of the book, that becomes a lot harder. I don't get 50 chapter letters from home either, you know. So the link can be a little problematic, but I even recommend, hold right on, I'm about to make a recommendation. Isn't that the awfulest feeling that you get just before you think you're going to sneeze and you're not sure if you are? I recommend that you read out loud. I think you do a better job reading when you read out loud. If you read silently, you kind of gloss over stuff. Read it out loud. Read it through. Get it in your mind. Or listen to it. You can get some marvelous recordings where people have voices to die for, you know.
Or
Alexander Scorby. Yeah. And, I mean, just listen to it. And it just kind of comes over you, you know. You're in kind of enveloped in this whole thing. But whatever trick you have, make sure you get that in your mind. Yes, Mark?
Well, with some of the, like even when I taught Romans here, mm-hmm. I mean, in the syllabus, on the reading assignments, I said, read at least the first 11 chapters
yes.
together,
yes.
you know, because it's all one unit.
Yes.
And, that's the whole point, to get it together. Is there any point, at, you know, you not only considering that, but the remote context as well? I mean, I know that takes you away from the text, but
it may have a remote context.
But you know, it is possible to read a paragraph, and if you don't consider something else that's said in the Bible, you
yes.
still could get.
And you're going to find this especially true in books that have a deep connection to Old Testament, and you're going to have to go back and read some stuff like we studied tonight to understand what went on. You know, you made the 2 Corinthians application there of Moses' face veiled. Unless you know the story in Exodus, like, what's that about? And that's remotely, you know, that's a whole book away, Old Testament versus New Testament, and hundreds of years, and yet it helps you understand what was going on there. So sometimes you have to chase those things down. You surely do. Good point. Thirdly is the exegetical perspective. Now, I'm going to say this is the one we have a tendency to start with. And I don't believe we're ready to study the words, the grammar, until we've done the other. It's like starting at the wrong end of the triangle. What we're doing is we are refining our study. We started here with the big end, the historical perspective. And we wanted to know all about the history. Then we analyzed the passage. We were narrowing in. Now we're down to words. That's the sharper end. But I have people who tell me, well, I get out my vines or something, I start looking up words. You're not ready to look up words at the beginning. That's the last thing you do. Now, we have to understand the Bible was not written in English. And I agonized over this next line on your notes. And this should motivate us to have some working knowledge of biblical languages. Only, even if it is only the ability to look up the word in vines or some other such volume. I tell you where I have seen preachers with egg all over their face is making an argument on an English translation. You can get in such trouble with that. Because words as we understand them do not necessarily mean what that word as originally used meant. Hosea 4:6 is one of my classic examples. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. I used to preach sermons on church members not knowing the things they needed to know, and they need to get into their Bibles and they need to study. And a professor in a graduate course pointed out to me that the root of that word was yada, which is the root of the same word when it says, and Adam knew Eve, and she conceived and bare a child. And all of a sudden, something clicked in my mind. Israel's problem was not that they did not know about God. What was Israel's problem? They didn't know God. I can use the verse because I think it has wonderful application today, because I think that's our problem. You know, we know a lot about God. Do we know God? And the question is, how do you get to know God? Well, first of all, you have to know about Him. But secondly, you have to spend time. You married folks, took you a while to know your wives, your husbands, to get to have that intimate kind of relationship with them that is precious and wonderful. And so all I'm saying is, understand that English translations are wonderful. If we didn't have them, we couldn't read the Bible. So we are indebted to translators. But just because there's an English word, we cannot make the argument on that English word until we make sure it's a good English word. I'll give you another illustration, Acts 2. What did Peter say about the soul of his Holy One? Where would it not be left? In hell. In hell. Old King James readers, that's what it says. Now, when you look up the word, and most subsequent translations make the correction, what is the word?
Hades.
What does Hades mean?
The unseen place.
The unknown. But could we really get in trouble using Acts 2 and letting somebody know that Christ went to hell? No. So, yes, Mark.
I think there's a point to be made even in, I like the order that you put this in, because that's even true of Greek words. For instance, when you look at a lexicon, where do you think they got the different meanings for that? Well, the way that it was used in different contexts.
Yes.
And so if you don't understand the context that you're... I've seen that a few times, not like I'm an expert in Greek or anything, but what I'm saying is, somebody makes an argument, and just because they go to a Greek word, everybody thinks, oh, you know, it's been made. But it's like they don't understand it. A Greek word is just like an English word. It can mean different things.
They evolve.
So unless you have the background of the context first, it doesn't do you any good to look that up, or less good.
Let me give you an illustration of a word evolving. What's a lyric?
Words to a song.
Words to a song. What's the root of lyric?
Liar.
What's a liar?
Musical instrument.
Well, that'll confuse you, won't it? A lyric is the words of the song. The root of it is lyre, which is a musical instrument. Does that tell you that through the ages, one thing kind of evolved into another meaning? Now, folks, that's why preaching's harder than people give it credit for being if you do it well. Now, if you get up and don't do it well, then that's another matter. But if you pay the price to study, we've got to allow our preachers time to sit in their offices or their studies and do the work. You don't have to necessarily get up and tell the people everything you know about a particular situation. You'll probably wear them out. They're probably not that interested. But you still have to be able to know the Scripture to handle it correctly. And that even comes down to the words. You need to have in your library some kind of word book that will at least give you an idea. W.E. Vine's an easy one because you can look up the word in English. You don't have to know a thing about it in Greek. It'll give you the Greek over there, and it'll look like some squigglies. You don't understand what they are. But you can look it up in English, and it will tell you where that word's used, how it's used, where it's used, and the basic meaning of it, and all the other words that are in that family that relate to that idea. And that'll help you in your study. Some helpful hints in this regard are: use an analysis of the text for exegesis. So I'm going to analyze the text, and I'm going to break it down and exegete, draw out of it the meaning. I'm going to record references in commentaries or other reference works. I'm going to understand that commentaries, I have seen people stand before an audience and preach out of Johnson's notes, or teach out of Johnson's notes. And I heard a fellow say, well, he said, well, Johnson says, and the fellow retorted, yes, but the Bible says, you got to be careful when you do that. Johnson was not even a member of the church, by the way, which doesn't ensure that he would have been right otherwise, but he has many things that are not very correct in his book, his volumes. You record any references in commentaries or other reference works. Be brief in giving your exegetical work. You're not writing a book. You're trying to understand the passage. Give careful attention to key words and phrases. As you look at a text, there are words that ought to leap out at you. I'll give you an example. For the grace of God that bringeth salvation hath appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. Is there a word that just kind of jumps out right there that this verse, this passage is about? That's Titus 2. Was there a word? Now, I realize I quoted it, you weren't looking at it, so that's not fair.
Sort of teaching leaps out at me.
Grace.
Grace. Yes. I think grace is a concept. The grace. The grace of God. God's the source. The grace of God that brings salvation. The purpose hath appeared to all men. That's the recipients. But what's the subject all along? Grace. As you read a passage, there's just words that just jump out, and you say, that's what it's about. This is a passage about grace. It tells us about, and it does go on to the next verse, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age. So you read it to look for key words and phrases. Examine the relationship of the parts of speech, nouns, verbs, adjectives, etc. It's a little tricky in Greek, because in English we've learned what part of speech goes first in the sentence. Subject. Mm-hmm. It's followed by the verb. Mm-hmm. Greek didn't know that. You're likely to find the verb anywhere and the noun anywhere. And it's like Pennsylvania Dutch says, the cow she in the backyard is. We wouldn't say it that way. So you've got to be careful. But you want to analyze what the relationship of nouns are to verbs and those kind of things. You are honing your study. You started out from the big end of the triangle. You're going to the sharp end where you're down to words now. If you do that, if you do it right, guess what should be the case when you get through?
People should be able to understand it.
You ought to understand that passage. You ought to have a good working knowledge. Does that mean you'll understand everything about the passage? Oh, no. You'll be looking at that passage for the next however many years you live, and you'll be discovering new things. But at least you've got a pretty good basic understanding of that passage, and then and only then are you in a position to kind of put stuff down. Don't put pen to paper until you've done the work of study. Now, number three, the preacher has the responsibility of applying the text chosen and studied to the needs of the people. The proper study described above will allow us to make the application to the needs of the people. I believe we want to be fresh and relevant. There are speakers that I love to hear, even on the radio. My car radio is set to a religious program, a religious station in Huntington, because every afternoon I think there are two of the best expositors on. I think Charles Swindoll is a very good expositor. He shows great understanding of the text. Now, he goes off when he gets to making application and doctrine. He gets a little squirrely. But I believe he does great work in exposition. And I like the way he thinks. He can make the passage flow. And I think it's very helpful. The fellow who's on after him, and I was going to tell you his name, and he used to preach in Memphis, and he's dead now, but they still have him on the radio. What's his name? Dr. somebody. But he too is a very good expositor. And I like to hear that, because that kind of stuff just kind of like, wow. That helps me understand the passage. And I have even as much as pull off the road, reach for a pen and tablet and write stuff down, because it's good stuff. That helps me in understanding that passage and making an application. We must pay the price in study to be fresh and relevant. Before we can know what a text means today, we must know what it meant to the original readers. Now, is that the way we look at a text?
Most of the time, no.
Okay. What do we look at?
This does.
What does it mean to us? Do you know it may not mean a thing in the world to you? Other than it's true and it's God's Word and it's inspired, but as far as your need, it may not mean a thing in the world to you. You can read about God telling Noah to go build an ark. How to go for it. Now, other than some principle you might get from that, what does that mean to you? Directly, how does that meet a need that you have?
It doesn't.
Now, you might take an extended principle from that you're supposed to do exactly what God said. But, that was spoken at another time to another person in another situation and doesn't have direct application to me. It may have a principle that's applicable to me. It may have direct application to me. I may be the one one of the ones that God had in mind when he had somebody write that down. But my first look is at what did this mean to the people who read it. I'll tell you a book where that becomes so crucial. Well, I'll let you just guess. What book in the Bible, if you started off with that understanding, would change the way people view it?
Revelation.
Revelation. Absolutely right. I listen to people also on the radio who just go crazy on Revelation. I mean, man, they've got stuff in there that I don't think John ever intended to be in Revelation. I'm not the first reader of Revelation. Who read it for the first time?
Christians.
Troubled Christians in the first century who were going through a terrible persecution. What would you expect the thrust of the book to be?
Somebody to comfort them.
Comfort to them. Now, can I draw some things from it? Are there applications? Yes. But I need to understand it was first read by people in the first century. It was a book written to them, in a sense. It was never written to me. I'm privileged to read it and to learn from it. But it was written, who was it written to? The seven churches of Asia, specifically. The struggling Christians, persecuted Christians, generally. I've got to go back. I've got to say, what was going on when that was written? What kind of persecution were those people going through? Who was the emperor? Now, that depends on someone when you date the book. But, you know, Paul told me that it was AD 96. So I'm trusting Paul on that one.
Second opinions.
But I want to, who most likely was the emperor? What kind of guy was he? What kind of specific persecutions were brought on the early Christians? What's this mark? What is that? You know, an ability to buy and sell. You know, what's that? What's that about? What would that have? What would have fit that? It starts off with the apocalypse, the word apocalypse. We say it's apocalyptic literature. What's one of the first things I want to look at? What is apocalyptic literature? What's characteristics of apocalyptic literature? And then I find out that it's signs and figures and exaggerated imagery. And I say, oh. When I read through Revelation, can I expect every word to be taken literally? No, because that's not the nature of the language. The language is signs and figures, exaggerated imagery. Oh, that helps me in knowing how to interpret Revelation. I've got to look at it understanding I'm not the original reader. How did the original readers understand what was being written? And what can I learn and what applies to me from that passage? Questions, comments about this Roman numeral 3? Preaching when it's done correctly is much harder than most people imagine. I've already said it because I feel it. A large part of the reason for that is the hours of diligent study it takes to analyze and understand the text. Consciously or unconsciously, most people listen to sermons to be helped. Zedekiah, Jeremiah 37:17. Remember the question that Zedekiah sent to Jeremiah? Is there a word from the Lord? I think that's why people listen to us. They want to know, is there a word from the Lord? You know what Jeremiah said? Yes, there is. You're not going to like it, but there is a word from the Lord. I think that's what we tell people. They come saying, is there a word from the Lord? We say, yes, there is. And here's what it is, and here's how it applies to you. Okay? What you got to say for yourselves now, after all has been said and done?
Well, you got finished early.
I know. I will probably call these 10 minutes back in at some point. I've been known to do that.
We have rollover
minutes.
Okay?
Huh?
We have rollover
minutes. Thank you so much, folks. I appreciate it.